From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. After 2 long months of lockdown, all 50 states are moving to partially reopen. President Trump applauded Americans who want to get back to work while touring a Ford plant in Michigan yesterday.
Americans who need and want to return to work should not be vilified. They should be supported.
Yet another 2.4 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, bringing the total number to nearly 39 million. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin told The Hill yesterday that more relief funding may be necessary.
I think there is a strong likelihood we will need another bill, but we just have $3 trillion we're pumping into the economy, and we're going to step back for a few weeks and think very clearly how we need to spend more money and if we need to do that.
And flooding devastates central Michigan after a dam failure. Thousands are displaced. Governor Gretchen Whitmer surveyed the damage on Wednesday.
On top of this 100-year event, we have a 500-year event in a flood that has absolutely devastated a lot of families, a lot of community, a lot of parts of this community.
It's our weekly news roundtable. With us from Washington first, Tolu Olurunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
And with us from Clarion, Pennsylvania, Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for The New York Times. Gina, great to have you with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Tolu, and Gina.
So let's start with the economy. 2.4 million Americans filed jobless claims last week. That's more than 38 million Americans out of work since the beginning of the pandemic. Looking at these numbers, you get whiplash, Gina. 9 weeks of devastation for the American worker. Break these down for us. What are economists seeing in these numbers? Gina? Ah, we lost Gina. Tolu, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Could you break down those numbers for us? What are we seeing there?
We're seeing a continuation of what is really the worst spate of joblessness that we've seen since the Great Depression. On average, we're seeing more than 3 million people on a given week file for unemployment. Now, the number just dipped below 3 million this past week, but it's still an incredibly elevated number. Before this pandemic, we would see maybe a few thousand, a couple hundred thousand people nationwide applying for unemployment benefits. During this spate, we've seen as many as 5-6 million people applying for unemployment. And the fact that we're still seeing millions of people applying for unemployment, 5, 6, 7 weeks into this crisis shows sort of the mass devastation that this crisis has continued to wreak on the economy. All states are seeing what looks like double-digit unemployment and really tough unemployment situations based on the fact that the economy has shut down nationwide and in many places. And it's a sign that it's going to take quite a while to dig out of this hole because we are so deep into this recession and we're still losing so many jobs. And it's a sign that the unemployment figures that we saw earlier this month are just sort of the beginning of the devastation, and we could see even worse numbers when we get national unemployment figures next month. Right now, we're already at near 15%, and it's clear that we may be going up even higher beyond that to levels that we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
Well, looking at these numbers, Jack, state by state, it's particularly striking. States like Kentucky and Georgia, close to 40% of workers in those states filing for first-time benefits. You're looking at far worse than Depression-era numbers here, Jack.
You are, and there's a strong and unmistakable class skew in the numbers. For example, 40% of the unemployment is among people earning $40,000 or less, whereas only 13% of unemployment people earning more than $100,000 a year. Moreover, and frighteningly, a study from the University of Chicago estimates that 42% of these jobs are not going to come back. That's mass unemployment for a long time. Congressional Budget Office estimates 9% unemployment well into next year. It could be higher than that. This is an unprecedented situation with the only precedent that Tolu mentioned, which was, of course, the Great Depression.
Here's the director of U.S. National Economic Council's Larry Kudlow, speaking to the Washington Post's Robert Costa yesterday during a live stream, said there are, quote, glimmers of hope amidst the anxiety and all this heartbreak.
The car companies are opening up their factories and trying to get the right mix of work return and safety. But that's also a good sign. Mortgage rates are low. In fact, interest rates are low in general. So it is not conclusive, Robert. I'm the first guy to admit that. I'm saying these are glimpses of a little bit of hope and growth. And we will see.
Gina Smilek, there's Larry Kudlow trying to be optimistic, but those weekly unemployment numbers are not good. They haven't been good for weeks. They're coming down. I mean, the trend is going in the right direction. It's going down, but that's little comfort when you're talking about one in four American workers who've either lost their job or been furloughed to. Gina.
Absolutely. And we just saw a ninth straight week of numbers in the millions, which is just, you know, while they are coming down, these numbers are basically without precedent still. You know, if we didn't have the last couple of weeks as a reference point, they would look apocalyptic. And so I think that it's really important to keep in mind that these numbers are still bad. People are broadly expecting the next couple of months of unemployment to be higher than the 14.7% we've already seen, which, as Jack mentioned, was really the highest since the Great Depression. And so most folks are expecting us to see 20 to 25% unemployment rates. You know, things are going to look better, I think, before they look or look worse before they look better.
On Tuesday, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified before the Senate Banking Committee. They warned of more economic damage to come, but they seem to propose two different solutions. Tolu, what did you hear in Mnuchin and Powell's messages this week?
Different senses of urgency. Powell seems to be trying to urge Congress to act very quickly to pump more money into the economy in addition to the $3 trillion worth of federal stimulus that has been approved so far. Mnuchin seemed to be saying, you know, we've already put a lot of money into the economy. Let's take a break. Let's see how it's working. We don't have that same sense of urgency to do something right away. And it's very clear that even though these two men have worked together, they're working on sort of massive historic federal intervention into the economy to try to prop up the economy. They have different ideas about what's needed at this point, with Mnuchin sort of being more reluctant to get on board with spending more federal money to try to prop up the economy, instead sort of trying to have more of a free market approach, saying that we need to get the economy working again by opening up businesses and letting the free market work as it is intended. I think Jerome Powell sees more uncertainty in the economy, and he sees this idea of having the federal government step in now with federal stimulus, with the idea that you can stem a lot of the bleeding, you can stave off a lot of the much worse economic impacts that you might have if you don't intervene. And they're having a little bit of a different opinion as to whether or not the federal government should try to do as much as possible now or allow the economy to kind of work through this issue on its own and allow businesses to take the reins and prop up the economy by opening up and allowing the businesses to take over.
Well, here's Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at that Senate Banking Committee hearing on the CARES Act on Tuesday, warning that unemployment numbers may continue to rise in the coming months.
When you have a situation where people are unemployed for long periods of time, that can permanently weigh on both their careers and their ability to go back to work, and also weigh on the economy for years. Equally so with small and medium-sized businesses, which are the jobs machine of our great economy. This is the biggest response by Congress ever, and the fastest and the biggest from us. And still, this is the biggest shock we've seen in living memory. And the question looms in the air of, is it enough?
It is the big question, Gina, and different perspectives, as Tolu said, between Mnuchin and Powell. Do you hear the Fed chair imploring Congress to do more there?
What he's been very clear in saying is that Congress may need to do more if this lasts for an extended period of time, and that this may last for an extended period of time. So I think he is kind of implicitly suggesting that there's a good chance that we're going to need to step up the response at all government levels, at the central bank, at a congressional level, and in the White House. I think the real thing that Chair Powell has been emphasizing over and over again is that we just don't want what is a really painful shock to turn into permanent scarring in the economy. And that is what's going to happen if we let small businesses and medium-sized businesses close because they have gone too long without revenues. And if we let workers, you know, default on their mortgage payments and fall really behind on their bills because they've gone too long without a paycheck.
So that to that point of permanent scarring, update us on the unemployment aid that Congress approved in late March that includes that extra $600 in weekly payments for unemployed Americans. This week during a closed-door meeting with Senate Republicans, the president said he was reluctant to extend that extra $600, those unemployment benefits included in the aid package. Those benefits expire in March. Tolu, what's the White House saying about that publicly?
Well, so far, we've seen the White House try to pump the brakes on the idea of extending those benefits. We've heard that President Trump is not on board with the idea of having those benefits extended, as Democrats would like to do, in part because it's sort of a growing theme among Republicans that this added benefit, $600 a week, is making it sort of more financially beneficial for people to stay at home rather than to go to work, that people are actually earning more on unemployment than they were working in some of the low-wage jobs that were lost as a part of this economic crisis. So Democrats are calling for an extension of these benefits, saying that people should have the opportunity to pay their bills and to sort of keep themselves financially afloat despite the fact that they've lost their jobs, while Republicans are saying we need to begin to reopen businesses, reopen the economy, essentially get people to be incentivized to go back to work by not having this crutch of, you know, $600 in extra weekly unemployment benefits. And so there's this fight going on between the White House and some members of Congress over what to do with this benefit as they think about whether or not to pass a phase four bill and what would be in it. It's a clear clash, and there's no resolution at this point on what should be done.
Well, we are talking about this week's top news stories. Tolu Olurunipa, Gina Smilek, and Jack Beatty. Stick with me. Up next, we'll dig into a Columbia University study that shows earlier lockdowns could have saved thousands of lives. Much more to come on our weekly news roundtable. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. It's our weekly news roundtable this hour, and I'm joined by a terrific panel today. Tolu Olurunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post, Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for The New York Times, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Well, all 50 states are now in some phase of reopening. Many accelerated their plans this week, but at least 17 states report a clear upward trend of coronavirus cases. Tolu, what do these numbers indicate, and is it possible to bend that curve back?
Well, they indicate what a lot of public health experts and even people within the Trump administration were saying when they decided about how we're going to go about opening the economy. They essentially said that you are going to see spikes. You are going to see an increase in some states because people are going to be out. They're going to be having interactions. And this is a highly contagious disease. Their goal was to be able to sort of contain that outbreak by having contact tracing, by having mechanisms in place to isolate people that have tested positive and to make sure that there's enough testing to know where the virus is and where it's spreading. It's not clear that we're there yet. And in order to bend the curve back down, we would need to significantly increase our testing, increase the ability to do contact tracing and making sure that people who are testing positive are isolated. But I think there is this broader existential struggle between the fight over the economy and the fight over health. And I think a number of governors, not a number of states, even sort of breaking down in a partisan way, on the Republican side are saying, even if it means we're going to have more cases, we need to reopen our economy, because if we don't, the devastation from the economic downturn is going to be worse than what we're seeing on the healthcare side. So states are forging ahead, hoping that there will not be a major outbreak. But even President Trump said, if there is a second wave, if there is a second major outbreak, that we're not going to shut down the economy again. So it's clear that some states are deciding to move on.
And so this tension continues, Jack Beatty, the fight over the economy versus the fight over health, with 50 governors doing 50 different things. It's hard to thread this needle in the right way. There is certainly no precedent for this, Jack.
There isn't, although there was. That is 1918. In one of our first shows about the pandemic, we cited literature showing that the contrast between how Philadelphia and St. Louis dealt with the second wave of virus in 1918. Philadelphia essentially, there was a 14-day interval between the time when Philadelphia shut down and the time when St. Louis did. And in the bargain, Philadelphia threw a victory parade. The result? Philadelphia, which was 14 days later, had a death rate of 257 per 100,000 population. St. Louis, it's 14 days earlier, and it shut down only 31 deaths per 100,000 population. At the time, we feared that the U.S. was Philadelphia. It is Philadelphia. What's St. Louis? Korea. Korea reported the first death was on the same day as the United States. Korea today has 264 deaths.
Mm-hmm. Gina Smilek, you've been, reporting all this reopening, and especially specifically on many restaurants that are opening up across this country, many opening at half capacity, a quarter capacity. Talk to us about the reporting you've done on the potentially lasting damage to the food services industry in this moment.
Right. One of the really interesting things that's going to happen with food services and really anything that requires people to congregate is a lot of the states are reopening in a way that only allows restaurants to operate at partial capacity. And often margins just don't work out at partial capacity. Restaurants are designed and sort of operated to be run at full capacity. And so if you say, hey, you can only have a quarter of the typical clientele that you would normally have in this restaurant, that may not be enough to cover rent. It certainly is. This appears to not be enough to rehire all of your staff. And so I think that what we've been hoping for, what many people have been hoping for, is a sort of a rapid bounce back as states reopen. But that's probably unrealistic, at least in these sort of high human contact, very dense sort of situations where you really just can't safely get the kind of reopening that would enable everyone to be hired back into their jobs and allow customers to come back in force.
Let me turn to a new study this week out of Columbia University, to this point of the conflict and the tension over the fight over the opening of the economy and the fight over health. Columbia suggests that more than 36,000 fewer Americans would have died in the coronavirus outbreak if social distancing measures had been imposed just 1 week earlier than they were. Tolu, that modeling is quite striking. Even small differences in timing would have prevented the worst exponential growth in places like New York and New Orleans. What did you make of that study?
Yeah, Jane, I think the word you use, exponential, is very key here, because we see how quickly this virus spreads, and even just a few days or a week worth of early intervention in other countries has shown major differences in how the virus spreads. If you're able to impose social distancing and get a little bit of control over the virus, thousands in the United States, tens of thousands of people could have been saved. And, you know, we've heard from the Trump administration about this. Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked about it yesterday, and he essentially said that, yes, it's true that if you took earlier action in hindsight, that many lives would have been saved. He quibbled a little bit with the number, saying that it's hard to know exactly how to model that. President Trump is sort of taken credit for stopping travel from China, saying that he did take early action. But I think this is going to be a major part of any after action report that is done on the coronavirus and the United States response. Why it took so long to impose social distancing measures, why there was not earlier action, and how many lives were lost as a result of the decision to wait until late March to to call for social distancing on a nationwide basis.
Here is President Trump dismissing the Columbia University study yesterday.
I was so early. I was earlier than anybody thought. I put a ban on people coming in from China. Everybody fought me on that. They didn't want it. Nancy Pelosi, a month later, was dancing in the streets of San Francisco in Chinatown so that people wouldn't believe what's happening. And I don't even blame that. But I was way early. Columbia is an institution that's very liberal. I think it's just a political hit job. You want to know the truth.
Jack Beatty, from the president's perspective, was it realistic to think about closing the country down when we didn't really have a full understanding of the full scope of what was going on?
Well, as I pointed out before, we did have the historical precedent, 1918, the literature I just cited about how urgent it was that to close down fast. And we did have the Korea example. They reacted drastically with mass testing, tracing, the whole works. And as I say, their death rate is now barely 300.
So clearly a big
mistake was made. Now, of course, the Trump people say, well, people wouldn't have gone for social distancing because there were only a few deaths at that time. We have the Korea example as, yes, there are only a few deaths there, too. They reacted, and the results are clear. You know, there was a Boston Globe editorial some weeks ago that said the president, quote, has blood on his hands. I remember looking at that and thinking, boy, that's pretty rough. This Columbia study, it isn't only the president, Mayor de Blasio, Governor Cuomo, these officials that were slow to act, the political ad writes itself for the fall. There is blood on their hands, and the president being the chief person up for reelection on his. This study will be used to make that argument. The president dithered. The result was, thousands more deaths.
Gina Smilek, and the economic implications of earlier restrictions?
Right. So I think it's two-part, right? If you have an earlier restriction, people lose their jobs earlier. But on the other hand, if you have an earlier restriction, there's a real possibility that you bend that curve immediately, that, you know, the virus comes under control and then you can reopen a lot earlier. And so I think most economists would argue that that second path, the one where you get things under control and then you can reopen in a more robust way down the line, is probably your better economic bet, which I think is also an important cautionary tale as we look at reopening. You know, you can make trade-offs where it feels like it's good in the moment. It seems like people are going to get their jobs back faster, but the long-run implications could actually be quite damaging economically if you have to shut down again or if you have to sort of have rolling shutdowns over the course of many months. Mm.
Let me turn now to the president's comments this week about mail voting, voting by mail, because this garnered a lot of attention this week. The president talked about giant fraud associated with voting by mail in Michigan and Nevada, two important battleground states. The president threatened to withhold funding because of this. Tolu, what's the significance of this issue, of the president's threat to withhold funding to these states if they move ahead with their voting by mail initiatives?
Yeah, it's a very significant move, and I think it's important to note that much of what the president has said on this issue is just simply not true. There's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. There are many states that do vote by mail exclusively, including Republican-led states, and they have not had major issues with voting fraud. And the president singled out Michigan and Nevada, two states run by Democrats, for mailing out absentee ballot applications to all their residents. But there are other states, including Georgia, which is led by a Republican governor, that have done the same thing, in part because they want people to have as many options as possible to vote safely, both in the primaries and in November. And that includes giving them the option to vote by mail. And several states have done this without any major voter fraud issues. I think one thing that's important to note is that we do see the president, the leader of the country, trying to essentially push for less options for people in terms of how they might vote. He's called for, you know, investigations into voter fraud, even though there have not been any major convictions for that on a wide scale basis. And a lot of concern has been raised that this would suppress the vote, that people who would normally vote may be sort of discouraged from voting because the president is saying that there's all this fraud and that vote by mail is laden with fraud. And I think it's important just to note that that is not the case in terms of what we've seen and in terms of how many states have been able to carry on mail-in voting without any major issues and without any major fraud.
Here's President Trump. It was on Wednesday. Yes, Jack, let me get you after this clip where President Trump is threatening to withhold federal funding from Michigan and Nevada for expanding these mail ballot initiatives. Here's Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford, his reaction on CNN yesterday.
I think we've heard from other jurisdictions that the intent is to suppress votes here, as indicated recently by some of your other guests. In Democratic elections, the president is concerned about losing those. And here in our state, interestingly, the Secretary of State is the one who oversees all of our elections. She's a Republican. And at the behest of our 17 counties, most of which lean Republican, she established this all-male primary system. And it's because of the COVID-19 scare.
Jack Beattie, fact check this voter fraud claim for us. Very important to understand what the president is saying here about mail-in ballots. Michigan sent out ballot applications, as Tolu said, not ballots themselves to register voters, which many states are also doing, Jack.
Yes, five states, nearly all voting is by mail, including very red Utah, and very little fraud. That's a infinitesimal statistically. This president's tweet come a week that there's been reporting on a new GOP plan to suppress voters turnout in November. 50,000 volunteers from the Trump campaign in 15 states are going to be monitoring polling places and challenging voters. Quote from the literature, voters deemed suspicious. I wonder what color those voters will be. This is setting up a potentially grave situation for November in these swing states, where by challenging the voters, the Trump people will throw sand in the works. The voting will be slowed down. Lines will lengthen. People will not vote. That's perhaps even a best case scenario. Or worse is that there could be violence with these 50,000 volunteers showing up at polling places. It's a very serious matter.
Well, staying in Michigan, speaking of Michigan and their voting by mail issue, let's move from that issue to President Trump's visit to a Ford factory in Michigan yesterday. The president said he tested negative for coronavirus, and that's one reason he gave for not wearing a mask while touring the factory. Mr. Trump was even encouraged by Bill Ford, the company's executive chairman, to please wear a mask. But Tolu, the president said he didn't want to give the press the pleasure of seeing him in a mask. Talk about this story, the significance of it, Tolu.
Yes, this is the president sort of flouting the rules. There are rules in the state of Michigan. There are rules put in by Ford, the company itself, that says that everyone who goes into that plant should be wearing a mask. The president said he wore the mask during the private part of the tour, but then once he got in front of the cameras, he decided to take the mask off because he did not want to give the press the pleasure of seeing him. I think it's important to note that this is not about the press. This is normally about a president showing leadership and sort of exemplifying the kind of activity that the rest of the country should be taking. But I think this mask issue has in some ways taken on a partisan lens. The president's strongest supporters on the Republican side have seen a mask as a sign of weakness and as a sign of sort of government control. And the president seems to be kind of giving them a signal of support by not wearing the mask, even though, according to polling, the vast majority of the country believes it makes sense to wear masks because it stops the spread of the disease and makes it harder for you to infect someone else. And it's just a sign of sort of being a good neighbor to your fellow Americans. But President Trump has instead sort of fanned the divisive flames around this issue by deciding not to wear a mask and sort of signaling to his supporters that he is going against the very advice that members of his administration, public health experts, have been saying everyone should be doing while they're in public. We have not yet seen the president follow that example yet.
Here's Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel taking aim at the president for not wearing a mask during his visit at the Ford plant. Here she is on CNN.
The president is like a petulant child who refuses to follow the rules. And I have to say, this is no joke. I mean, you just reported that 93,000 people have died in the United States. He's in a county right now where over 100 people have died. I am 20 minutes away from him in Wayne County, where we've had over 2,300 people die. This is not a joke. And he's conveying the worst possible message to people who cannot afford to be on the receiving end of terrible misinformation.
Gina Smilek, clearly some political overtones to all of this, and many saying this is just politicizing this health issue. How did you see that this week?
Yeah, it is an interesting question of whether, you know, this is just purely sending a political message. It's interesting. Anecdotally, I am out in the middle of Pennsylvania, and every time I go grocery shopping, it's really interesting to see that, you know, quite commonly folks are not wearing masks. And if you mention it to them or ask them about it, it does seem to be very much a political statement. I feel like it was interesting for me to watch, you know, just personally watch the president's saga play out this week, just because it does seem to be sort of sending a message to those folks in his base in sort of these Republican parts of the country who very much see this as sort of a signaling device over whether, you know, you think the country should be reopening, over whether you think people are taking coronavirus too seriously. And I think this was a real doubling down there, it seemed.
Well, we're discussing the week's top news stories this hour. After the break, we'll take a look at President Trump's choice to take the drug hydroxychloroquine. We'll look at the race to a coronavirus vaccine, among other things. Stick with us, more to come. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Welcome back to our Week in the News Roundtable. We have a great panel this week. Tolu Oluwanipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for The New York Times. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Well, President Trump this week said he had been taking hydroxychloroquine as a preventative measure against coronavirus. This announcement came less than a month after the FDA had issued a safety warning about the drug. Here is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responding to this, sharing her disapproval on CNN on Monday.
He's our president, and I would rather he not be taking something that has not been approved by the scientist, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, what is morbidly obese, they say. So I think it's not a good idea.
Tolu, beyond that personal slap there, tell us what prompted the president's decision to take this drug.
Well, coronavirus has gotten into the White House. A couple of weeks ago, a couple of people tested positive, including people who had interacted with the president and had gotten close to the president. And the president had, for months now, been talking up hydroxychloroquine as this cure-all, saying it could be a game changer, pointing to anecdotal evidence of people that he had heard that had taken the drug and had been cured or been able to recover from coronavirus. It's important to say that there are a number of studies that have shown that the drug hydroxychloroquine is not a cure-all, that it's not an approved cure for coronavirus, and in some cases it can lead to actual worse health outcomes. There was a study that was just published and released today that was reported in the Washington Post, a study of 96,000 people that found that coronavirus patients who took hydroxychloroquine actually had a higher rate of death and heart complications than people who didn't take it. And that's part of the reason why we've heard so many health experts say that it's not a good idea to be taking this drug without hospital supervision or as part of a clinical trial. It's not something that you should be taking as a prophylactic the way the president has been taking it, sort of as a preventative measure. There's no data or scientific evidence that it works that way, and that it could be actually harmful to the health of Americans who take it without the right health precautions. So this has been another wrinkle in which the president has gone astray from the public health experts and where he's decided to do his own thing. He has said that it hasn't had any negative impact on him and that he's doing fine. But in terms of having an example for the rest of the country, I think most of the public health experts, including the doctors in the Trump administration, are saying that it's not a good idea to be taking this drug unless you have a clear sign from your doctor that that's the right thing that you should be doing. Mm.
So interesting, Jack Beattie, that study in the Washington Post that Tulu referenced, almost 100,000 patients, coronavirus patients, hydroxychloroquine actually made their situation worse. They had a higher risk of death compared to those who did not. So we have the medical experts warning about the health dangers, but the president setting a very different example here, Jack.
Yes, as with not wearing the mask. Jonathan Reiner, who's at George Washington University in their cardiac unit, was on CNN last night, and he said that these things are responsible for deaths. That is, the president not wearing a mask, the president touting, as he calls it, hydroxy. These will, or perhaps have, these actions resulted in people dying. That the president is, he's sort of the, as someone called him, the vector in chief in this regard. And, you know, when he first started touting this drug, I thought, well, this may be a scam. There may be a financial interest. Apparently there isn't, although some big Republican donors have some stake in the French company that produces this mostly. But it seems like with the president, he believes it. He's willfully ignorant about this. And that is a terrible model to show to the people. We need to see our leader acting as a leader should, which is to model best practices, not worst.
Gina Smilek, the race to a coronavirus vaccine got a financial boost this week. AstraZeneca, which is working on a vaccine in Great Britain, announced it received $1.2 billion from the Trump administration to produce 300 million doses of its vaccine, even though the trials have yet to prove efficacy. What did you see in that story this week, Gina?
I think the interesting thing, and, you know, this is the fourth such agreement, but by far the largest that's been made. The interesting thing is that what we're really seeing is researchers and nonprofits and the government really throw all resources at these trials to try and make sure that when we get a vaccine that is effective, it's also sort of all of the parts of the pipeline that are necessary to ramp up production really quickly are already in place. That's a big financial gamble. You know, there's every chance that these vaccines may not pan out, in which case a lot of that productive capacity could just be lost or could be wasted. But what Dr. Anthony Fauci has said in interviews about this topic is that, you know, in an instance like this, where the trade-off is so significant, where the public health interest is so important, you know, it's worth making those financial investments, even if there's a good chance that a lot of that money is going to be lost, because the hope and the real ambition here is that instead of the really protracted time period that it takes to bring vaccines like this to market, they'll be able to kind of condense that period and save lives in the process.
Tulu, the president has called the race for a vaccine Operation Warp Speed. Update us on this from your perspective from the White House.
Well, the president is really relying on the idea that we would have a vaccine very quickly. He's looking at the political calendar in addition to the economic calendar. He's hoping that this vaccine would be in place before the end of the year, essentially before the election in November, and that with a vaccine, we would be able to return to normalcy, that businesses would be able to make plans to ramp up, and essentially schools and all manner of public life would be able to return to normalcy once not only a vaccine is ready, but also a part of this Operation Warp Speed is getting mass production of a vaccine so that, you know, the 325 million people in America could use this vaccine if they want to. And that's part of a major gamble that the president is essentially making, that he would be able to push forward this effort and get everything in place so that if the scientists are able to come up with a vaccine, that it would be able to be pushed out and distributed very quickly to large numbers of people. This is something that essentially has never been done before, that the president is trying to take credit for. It is a major gamble because we have other kinds of diseases, including HIV, and that have not been able to find vaccines, even though they've been in the community and in the world for a long time, for very many years, and the vaccine has been elusive. So the president has made it clear that he is optimistic about having a vaccine by the end of the year, but even the public health experts within the Trump administration have said that best case scenario would be having a vaccine, you know, later on next year sometime. It would be 12 to 18 months away. So we'll have to see about whether or not this gambit works. But it's clear that the president is looking at the political calendar and saying that he wants to reopen the country and have the economy moving and sort of firing on all cylinders before his election so that he can make that pitch to the country that he brought the economy back from the brink.
Let's move to the State Department now. At a press conference on Wednesday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo defended his recommendation that President Trump this week fire Inspector General Steve Linnick.
The president has the unilateral right to choose who he wants to be his inspector general at every agency in the federal government. They are presidentially confirmed positions, and those persons, just like all of us, serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States. In this case, I recommended to the president that Steve Linnick be terminated. I frankly should have done it some time ago.
So Steve Linnick had been investigating a controversial arms sale to Saudi Arabia, as well as the alleged use of State Department aid to run personal errands for the Secretary of State, Pompeo. Tolu, back to you on this. Tell us about these investigations and why this is significant.
Yeah, the president has been on a tear in terms of getting rid of inspectors general, people who conduct oversight over the administration, especially in the wake of the impeachment hearing. And this latest example is an example of the president sort of going against all kinds of norms about presidential oversight and essentially getting rid of the watchdog, someone who was investigating one of his cabinet members over a number of different things, from the way he is using taxpayer resources to the way he appeared to have flouted the will of Congress with his dealings with Saudi Arabia. The president was asked about this, and he said, you know, Mike Pompeo asked me to fire this person. I know nothing about it, and I just agreed with Mike Pompeo. And now the Secretary of State is under fire for essentially getting rid of somebody who was very clearly investigating him. And it's just another example of this administration flouting the idea of independent oversight or the idea of having to answer to anyone within the administration. And it is true, according to Mike Pompeo, he is on firm ground in saying that the president has the legal right to get rid of an inspector general. But that has not been the spirit of the law. That has not been the spirit of how presidents have worked in the past. They've said that they would be willing to submit to oversight because they have nothing to hide. And in this case, President Trump is saying that he feels that he has already submitted to a lot of oversight with the Mueller investigation and with his impeachment. And he's essentially washing his hands of the process and using his full powers to get rid of anyone who is in his authority.
And it's not just at the State Department. The acting inspector general at the Department of Transportation was just replaced. Democrats say he was probing into whether Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao steered grants to projects in Kentucky, the state her husband, Mitch McConnell, represents. Gina Smilek, what did you see in all this week?
One thing that I think people have raised as a real concern out of these changes and these firings is that inspectors general could take a message from this that they are potentially going to be fired just for doing their jobs. Now, there's been pushback within the administration on that idea. Pompeo, for example, said that, you know, this is not going to send that message. Instead, it's going to send quite the opposite message that, you know, if people don't do the job that they were hired to do in their presidential appointments, that they are, in fact, going to be removed from their positions. But I think there's pretty widespread concern that, you know, in these instances, if the widespread perception is that people were removed because of political retaliation or because, you know, they were seen as too much of a nuisance, that might have a chilling effect. And these inspector generals, who perform a really important role in government in the sense that they hold these agencies and bureaucracies really accountable for the things that they're doing on a day-to-day basis, that they might sort of have a little bit of a less toothy relationship to the agencies they're supposed to be overseeing.
Jack Beatty, President Trump has fired or replaced five independent watchdogs, five in the last 6 weeks.
Yes, and from the GOP Senate, crickets, except for the honorable exception of Mitt Romney, who has rightly denounce this. You know, where is the public interest here in getting rid in you know, gelding these offices? The public, even Trump voters, have a stake in honest government, in ending corruption. And Trump is politicizing this as he's politicized everything else. He can't bear scrutiny of what he does, whether it's from the judiciary, the press, or these inspectors general.
Let me get this story in. President Trump has decided to withdraw from another major arms control accord. The U.S. is now pulling out of the Open Skies Treaty with Russia. Let me play this clip. This is a press conference yesterday. Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Hoffman said the United States has clearly shared concerns over Russia's adherence to the Open Skies Treaty for many years.
The United States does remain fully committed to agreements that advance U.S. allied and partner security, are verifiable and enforceable, and include partners that comply responsibly with their obligations. What I can tell you is that Russia flagrantly and continuously violates its obligations under Open Skies and implements the treaty in ways that contribute to military threats against the United States and our allies and partners.
Tolu, the president said Russia has not adhered to this treaty, so it's essentially useless. The U.S. is out. What do you say?
Yeah, it's not clear whether or not the president is using this as sort of a threat. Sometimes he does that. He threatens to do the most extreme thing, to walk away from the table to try to get some concessions from another party in the negotiations. But we've seen the president pull the trigger in the past on some of these arms treaties and move away from them, move the country out of them without having any kind of alternative. And this could happen as well in this case, where, you know, the one treaty that sort of all these major countries were abiding by or sort of using to keep themselves out of a major conflagration or war, the president sort of walks away from because he doesn't believe the other parties were doing enough to comply. So this could be another example of that. And it really remains to be seen whether or not this is a negotiating gambit or whether the president just walks away from this treaty and the rest of the country has to wait and see what happened next.
Well, and there are real questions about whether the president may be poised to leave another treaty, the last major arms treaty that the U.S. has with Russia, the New START treaty, which limits the number of nuclear missiles each country can have. Will these treaties be replaced quickly, Tolu?
Right now, the president has a much bigger track record of breaking down treaties and walking away from negotiations than he has of putting together major agreements. So I wouldn't be surprised if he walks away from any of these treaties with very little time left in his first term, if he just leaves them broken without any resolution.
Couple minutes left after a very informative hour. I'd like each of you to look ahead for us. What's on the horizon for you this week? What have you got your eye on? What are you watching? Gina Smilek, I'll start with you.
I think I'm still watching the economic data. You know, we are getting some of the first readings from the early reopening in these states. And I think there's a real open question about how fast we bounce back from the lockdowns, even as places begin to sort of tiptoe into this reopening. And I think we're going to begin to get answers to those questions this week. You know, we've already seen some early signs from Georgia, which was very early to reopen. And it's looked like people are only coming back at partial capacity. You know, as we get more readings on states that have been mm-hmm. headed in the same direction, we'll see if that's a common trend.
Tolu, about 20 seconds for you. What are you seeing?
I'm just watching the healthcare side of things. We have a number of different vaccines that we're watching to see if they have any promising data. And we also have the issue of whether or not cases are spiking in various states. I'll be watching that very closely.
Jack Beatty, 20 seconds for you. Get the last word.
Will the administration snap out of its Herbert Hoover days and recognize that the only path for reelection for the president is to immediately pass the $3 trillion stimulus bill passed by the House? That's his ticket, and they don't seem to recognize it.
Thanks to all of you. Really appreciate it. Another busy week, and you all have been working hard. Thanks for being here to share your reporting with us. Tolu Oluwanipa, really appreciate your time. White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, thank you.
Thanks, Shane.
Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for The New York Times. Gina, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.